This is Audible.
Audible Inc. presents Alas, Babylon. Written by Pat Frank. Narrated by Will Patton.
Preface. I have an acquaintance, a retired manufacturer, a practical man, who has recently become worried about international tensions, international missiles, H-bombs, and such. One day, knowing that I had done some writing on military subjects, he asked, "What do you think would happen if the Ruskies hit us when we weren't looking, you know, like Pearl Harbor?" The subject was on my mind. I had recently returned from a magazine assignment at Offutt Field, headquarters of the Strategic Air Command, several SAC operational bases, and the Missile Test Center on Cape Canaveral. More to the point, I had been discussing just such a possibility with several astute British staff officers. The British have lived under the shadow of nuclear-armed rockets longer than we. Also, they have a vivid memory of cities devastated from the skies, as have the Germans and Japanese. A man who has been shaken by a 2-ton blockbuster has a frame of reference. He can equate the impact of an H-bomb with his own experience, even though the H-bomb blast is a million times more powerful than the shock he endured. To someone who has never felt a bomb, bomb is only a word. An H-bomb's fireball is something you see on television. It is not something that incinerates you to a cinder in the thousandth part of a second. So the H-bomb is beyond the imagination of all but a few Americans, while the British, Germans, and Japanese can comprehend it, if vaguely, and only the Japanese have personal understanding of atomic heat and radiation. It was a big question. I gave him a horseback opinion, which proved conservative compared with some of the official forecasts published later. I said, "Oh, I think they'd kill 50 or 60 million Americans, but I think we'd win the war." He thought this over and said, "Wow, 50 or 60 million dead. What a depression that would make." I doubt if he realized the exact nature and extent of the depression, which is why I'm writing this book. 1959. 1. In Fort Repose, a river town in Central Florida, it was said that sending a message by Western Union was the same as broadcasting it over the combined networks. This was not entirely true. It was true that Florence Wetcheck, the manager, gossiped. Yet she judiciously classified the personal intelligence that flowed under her plump fingers and maintained a prudent censorship over her tongue. The scandalous and the embarrassing she excised from her conversation. Sprightly, trivial, and harmless items she passed on to friends, thus enhancing her status and relieving the tedium of spinsterhood. If your sister was in trouble and wired for money, the secret was safe with Florence Wetcheck. But if your sister bore a legitimate baby, its sex and weight would soon be known all over town. Florence awoke at 6:30, as always, on a Friday in early December. Heavy, stiff, and graceless, she pushed herself out of bed and padded through the living room into the kitchen. She stumbled onto the back porch, opened the screen door a crack, and fumbled for the milk carton on the stoop. Not until she straightened did her china blue eyes begin to discern movement in the hushed gray world around her. A jerky-tailed squirrel darted out on the longest limb of her grapefruit tree. Sir Percy, her enormous yellow cat, rose from his burlap couch behind the hot water heater, arched his back, stretched, and rubbed his shoulders on her flannel robe. The African lovebirds rhythmically swayed, heads pressed together on the swing in their cage. She addressed the lovebirds. "Good morning, Anthony. Good morning, Cleo." Their eyes, spectacularly ringed in white as if embedded in mint lifesavers, blinked at her. Anthony shook his green and yellow plumage and rasped a greeting. Cleo said nothing. Anthony was adventurous, Cleo timid. On occasion, Anthony grew raucous and irascible, and Florence released him into limitless freedom outside. But always at dusk, Anthony waited in the Turk's cap or atop the frangipani eager to fly home. So long as Cleo preferred comfortable and sheltered imprisonment, Anthony would remain a domesticated parrot. That's what they'd told her when she bought the birds in Miami a month before, and apparently it was true. Florence carried their cage into the kitchen and shook fresh sunflower seed into their feeder. She filled Sir Percy's bowl with milk and crumpled a bit of wafer for the goldfish in the bowl on the counter. She returned to the living room and fed the angelfish, mollies, guppies, and vivid neons in the aquarium. She noted that the two miniature catfish, useful scavengers, were active. She was checking the tank's temperature and its electric filter and heater when the percolator chuckled its call to breakfast. At 7 exactly, Florence switched on the television, turned the knob to Channel 8 Tampa, and sat down to her orange juice and eggs. Her morning routine was unvaried and efficient. The only bad parts of it were cooking for one and eating alone. Yet breakfast was not her loneliest meal, not with Anthony ogling and gabbling, the 6 fat goldfish dancing a dreamy oriental ballet on diaphanous fins, Sir Percy rubbing against her legs under the table, and her cheery friends on the morning show, hired at great expense to inform and entertain her. As soon as she saw Dave's face, Florence could sense whether the news was going to be good or bad. On this morning, Dave looked troubled. And sure enough, when he began to give the news, it was bad. The Russians had sent up another Sputnik, number 23, and something sinister was going on in the Middle East. Sputnik number 23 was the largest yet, according to the Smithsonian Institution, and was radioing continuous and elaborate coded signals. "There's reason to believe," Frank said, "that Sputniks of this size are equipped to observe the terrain of the earth below." Florence gathered her pink flannel robe closer to her neck. She glanced up apprehensively through the kitchen window. All she saw were hibiscus leaves dripping in the pre-dawn ground fog and blank gray sky beyond. They had no right to put those Sputniks up there to spy on people. As if it were on his mind also, Frank continued, "Senator Holler of the Armed Services Committee yesterday joined others of a Midwest bloc in demanding that the Air Force shoot down Sputniks capable of military espionage if they violate U.S. airspace. The Kremlin has already had something to say about this. Any such action, the Kremlin says, will be regarded the same as an attack on a Soviet vessel or aircraft. The Kremlin pointed out that the United States has traditionally championed the doctrine of freedom of the seas. The same freedom, says the Soviet statement, applies to outer space." The newsman paused, looked up, and half-smiled in wry amusement at this complexity. He turned a page on his clipboard. "There's a new crisis in the Middle East. A report from Beirut via Cairo says that Syrian tanks of the most modern Russian design have crossed the Jordanian frontier. This is undoubtedly a threat to Israel. At the same time, Damascus charges that Turkish troops are mobilizing." Florence flipped to Channel 6, Orlando, and country music. She did not understand and could not become interested in the politics of the Middle East. Sputnik seemed a closer and more personal menace. Her best friend Alice Cooksey, the librarian, claimed to have seen a Sputnik one evening at twilight. If you could see it, then it could see you. She stared up through the window again. No Sputnik. She rinsed the dishes and returned to her bedroom. As she wrestled with her girdle, Florence's thought gravitated to the equally prying behavior of Randy Bragg. She adjusted the Venetian blinds until she could peer out. He was at it again. There he was, brazenly immodest, in checked red and black pajamas, sitting on his front steps, knees akimbo and binoculars pressed to his eyes. Although he was perhaps 75 yards distant, she was certain he stared directly at her and could see through the tilted louvers. She ducked back against the bedroom wall, hands protecting her breasts. Almost every evening for the past 3 weeks and on a number of mornings she had caught him at it. Sometimes he was on the piazza, as now, sometimes at a second-floor window, and sometimes high up on the captain's walk. Sometimes he swept the whole of River Road with his glasses, pretending an interest elsewhere, but more often he focused on her bungalow. Randolph Rousey Bragg, a peeping Tom. It was shocking. Long before Florence's mother moved south and built the brown shingle bungalow, the Braggs had lived in the big house, ungainly and monolithic, with tall Victorian windows and bellying bays and broad brick chimneys. Once it had been the showplace of River Road. Now it appeared shabby and outmoded compared with the long, low, antiseptic citadels of glass, metal, and tinted block constructed by rich northerners who for the past 15 years had been discovering the Timaquin River. Still, the Bragg house was planked and paneled with native cypress and encased in pine clapboard, hard as iron, that might last another 100 years. Its grove at this season, like a full green cloak flecked with gold, trailed all the way from backyard to riverbank, the quarter mile. And she would say this for Randy. His grounds were well kept, bright with poinsettias and bougainvillea, hibiscus, camellias, gardenias, and flame vine. Florence had known Randolph's mother, Gertrude Bragg, well, an old Judge Bragg to speak to. She had watched Randolph graduate from bicycle to jalopy, vanish for a number of years in college and law school, reappear in a convertible, vanish again during the Korean War, and finally come home for good when Judge Bragg and Mrs. Bragg were taken in the same year. Now, here was Randy, one of the best-known and most eligible young men in Timaquin County, even if he did run around with Pistolville girls and drink too much, eh? What was it the French called it? A voyeur. It was disgusting. The things that went on in small towns people wouldn't believe. Florence faced the bureau mirror, wondering how much he had seen. Many years ago, a man had told her she looked something like Clara Bow. Thereafter, Florence wore her hair in bangs and didn't worry too much about her chubby figure. The man, an imaginative idealist, had gone to England in 1940, joined the commandos, and got himself killed. She retained only a vague and inexact memory of his caresses, but she could never forget how he had compared her to Clara Bow, a movie star. She could still see a resemblance, provided she sucked in her stomach and lifted her chin high to erase the fleshy creases in her neck, except her hair was no longer like Clara's. Her hair had thinned and faded to mottled pink. She hurriedly sketched a Clara Bow pout on her lips and finished dressing. When she stepped out of the front door, Florence didn't know whether she should cut Randy dead or give him a piece of her mind. He was still there on the steps, the binoculars in his lap. He waved, grinned, and called across lawn and road, "Morning, Miss Florence." His black hair was tousled, his teeth white, and he looked boyish, handsome, and inoffensive. "Good morning, Randy," Florence said. Because of the distance, she had to shout, so her voice was not formal and frigid as she had intended. "You look real pretty and chipper today," he yelled. She walked to the carport, head averted as if avoiding a bad odor, her stiff carriage a reprimand, and did not answer. He really was nervy, sitting there in those vile pajamas trying to sweet-talk her. All the way to town, she kept thinking of Randy. Who would ever guess that he was a deviant with a compulsion to watch women dress and undress? He ought to be arrested. But if she told the sheriff or anybody, they would only laugh at her. Everybody knew that Randy dated lots of girls and not all of them virgins. She herself had seen him take Rita Hernandez, that little Menorcan tart from Pistolville, into his house and no doubt up to his bedroom since the lights had gone on upstairs and off downstairs. And there had been others. Recently a tall blonde who drove her own car, a new Imperial with Ohio plates, into the circular driveway and right up to the front steps as if she owned the place. And Randy. Nobody would believe that he found it necessary to absorb his sex at long range through optic nerves and binoculars. Yet it was strange that he had not married. It was strange that he lived alone in that wooden mausoleum. He even had his office in there, instead of in the professional building like the other lawyers. He was a hermit, and a snob, and a nigger lover, and no better than a pervert. God knows what he did with those girls upstairs. Maybe all he did was make them take off their clothes and put them on again while he watched. She had heard of such things. And yet, she couldn't make herself believe there was anything basically wrong with Randy. She had voted for him in the primaries and stood up for him at the meetings of the Frangipani Circle when those garden club biddies were pecking him to bits. After all, he was a brag and a neighbor, and besides, he obviously needed help and guidance. Randy's age, she knew, was 32. Florence was 47. Between people in their 30s and 40s, there wasn't too wide a gap. Perhaps all he needed, she decided, was a little understanding and tenderness from a mature woman. Randy watched Florence's 10-year-old Chevy diminish and disappear down the tunnel of live oaks that arched River Road. He liked Florence. She might be a gossipy old maid, but she was probably one of the few people on River Road who had voted for him. Now she was acting as if he were a stranger trying to cash a money order without credentials. He wondered why. Maybe she disapproved of Lib McGovern, who had been in and out of the house a good deal in the last few weeks. What Florence needed, he guessed, was the one thing she was unlikely to get. A man. He rose, stretched, and glanced up at the bronze weathercock on the garage steeple. Its beak pointed resolutely northeast. He checked the large, reliable marine barometer and its twin thermometer alongside the front door. Pressure, 30.17, up 20 points in 12 hours. Temperature, 62. It would be clear and warm, and the bass might start hitting off the end of the dock. He whistled and shouted, "Graff! Hey, Graff!" Leaves rustled under the azalea bed, and a long nose came out, followed by an interminable length of dachshund. Graff, his red coat glistening and tail whipping, bounded up the steps, supple as a seal. "Come on, my short-legged friend," Randy said, and went inside, binoculars swinging from his neck for his second cup of coffee, the cup with the bourbon in it. Except for the library, lined with his father's law books, and the game room, Randy rarely used the first floor. He had converted one wing of the second floor into an apartment suitable in size to a bachelor and to his own taste. His taste meant living with as little exertion and strain as possible. His wing contained an office, a living room, a combination bar and kitchen alcove, and bedroom and bath. The decor was haphazard, designed for his ease, not a guest's eye. Thus he slept in an outsized mahogany slave bed imported from New England by some remote ancestor, but it was equipped with a foam rubber mattress and contour nylon sheets. When in boredom, he wasted an evening preparing a full meal for himself. He ate from Staffordshire, bearing the Bragg crest, and with silver from Paul's store, and by candlelight, but he laid his place on the Formica bar separating living room from efficient kitchen. Now he sat on a stool at this bar, half-filled a fat mug with steaming coffee, dropped two lumps of sugar into it, and laced it with an inch of bourbon. He sipped his mixture greedily. It warmed him all the way down. Randy didn't remember exactly when he had started taking a drink or two before breakfast. Dan Gunn, his best friend and probably the best medic north of Miami, said it was an unhealthy practice and the hallmark of an alcoholic. Not that Dan had reprimanded him. Dan had just advised him to be careful and not let it become a habit. Randy knew he wasn't an alcoholic because an alcoholic craved liquor. He never craved it. He just drank for pleasure, and the most pleasurable of all drinks was the first one on a crisp winter morning. Besides, when you took it with coffee, that made it part of breakfast, and therefore not so depraved. He guessed he had started it during the campaign, when he had been forced to load his stomach with fried mullet, hush puppies, barbecued ribs dripping fat, chitlins, roasted oysters gritty with sand, and to wash all down with warm beer and raw rotgut. After such nights, only mellow bourbon could clear his head and launch him on another day. Bourbon had buoyed him during the campaign, and now bourbon mercifully clouded its memory. He could have beaten Porky Logan, certainly, except for one small tactical error. Randy had been making his first speech at Pasco Creek, a cow town in the north end of the county, when somebody shouted, "Hey, Randy, Where do you stand on the Supreme Court? He had known this question must come, but he had not framed the right kind of answer. The moderate, southern, quasi-liberal, semi-segregationist double-talk that would have satisfied everybody except the palmetto scrub wool hats, the loud-mouthed cluxers and courthouse whittlers who would vote for Porky anyway, and the Georgia and Alabama riffraff crowding the Menorcans for living space in the shanties and three-room bungalows of Pistolville. The truth was that Randolph Bragg himself was torn by the problem, recognizing its dangers and complexities. He had certain convictions. He had served in Korea and Japan, and he knew that the battle for Asia was being lost in counties like Timaquin. He also knew that Pasco Creek had no interest in Asia. He believed integration should start in Florida, but it must begin in the nursery schools and kindergartens and would take a generation. This was all difficult to explain, but he did voice his final conviction, inescapable because of his legal heritage and training and the oaths he had taken as voter and soldier. He said, "I believe in the Constitution of the United States, all of it." There had been snickers and snorts from the rim of the crowd, and his listeners, except for the reporters from Tampa, Orlando, and the County Weekly, had drifted away. In later speeches elsewhere, he attempted to explain his position, but it was hopeless. Behind his back, he was called a fool and a traitor to his state and his race. Randolph Rousey Bragg, whose great-grandfather had been a United States senator, whose grandfather had been chosen by President Wilson to represent his country as minister plenipotentiary and envoy extraordinary in time of war, whose father had been elected without opposition to half a dozen offices, Randolph was beaten 5-1 in the Democratic primaries for nomination to the state legislature. It was worse than defeat. It was humiliation. And Randy knew he could never run for public office again. He refilled his mug, this time with more bourbon than coffee. And Missouri, his maid, shuffled in the hallway and knocked. He called, "Come in, Mizzou." Missouri opened the door, pushing a vacuum cleaner and carrying a pail filled with cans, bottles, and rags. Missouri was the wife of Two-Tone Henry, neighbor as well as maid. She was 6 inches shorter than Two-Tone, who was just Randy's height, 5'11", but Two-Tone claimed she outweighed him by 100 pounds. If this was true, Missouri weighed around 240. But on this morning, it seemed to Randy that she had dwindled a bit. "You dieting, Mizzou?" he said. "No, sir, I'm not dieting. I got nerves." Nerves? Missouri had always seemed nerveless, solid and placid as a broad, deeply rooted tree. "Two-Tone been giving you a bad time again?" "No, Two-Tone been behaving. He down on a dock fishing right now. To tell you the truth, Mr. Randy, as Mrs. McGovern, she followed me around with white gloves." Missouri worked 2 hours each morning for Randy and the rest of the day for the McGoverns, who lived half a mile closer to town. The McGoverns were the W. Foxworth McGoverns, the Central Tool and Plate McGoverns, formerly of Cleveland, and the parents of Lib McGovern, whose proper name was Elizabeth. "What do you mean, Mizzou?" Randy asked, fascinated. "After I dust, she follow me around with white gloves to see as I dusted. I know I cleans clean, Mr. Randy." "You sure do, Mizzou." Missouri plugged in the vacuum cleaner, started it, and then shut it off. She had more on her mind. "That ain't all. You been in that house, Mr. Randy. You ever seen so many ashtrays?" "What's wrong with ashtrays?" "She don't allow no ashes in 'em. That poor Mr. McGovern, he has to smoke his cigars outside. Then there was that roach, big roach in the silver drawer. Mrs. McGovern opened that drawer yesterday and saw that roach and screeched like she'd been hit by a scorpion. She made me go through every drawer in the kitchen and dining room and put down fresh paper. Was that roach sent me to Dr. Gunn yesterday. Mrs. McGovern, she can't bide bugs or little green lizards, and she won't go out of the house after dark for fear of snakes. I don't think the McGovern's going to be with us long, Mr. Randy, because what's Florida except bugs and lizards and snakes? I think they leave around May when bug season starts good. But Miss McGovern, she won't want to leave. She's stuck on you." What makes you think so? Missouri smiled. Questions, she asked, like what you eats for breakfast? Missouri glanced at the decanter on the bar. And who cooks for you, and does you have other girls? Randy changed the subject. You say you went to see Dr. Gunn. What did he say? Doctor says I'm a complicated case. He says I got high blood on account of I'm heavy. He says it's good I'm losing weight because that lowers the high blood, but fretting about Mrs. McGovern white-gloving me is the wrong way to do it. He says quit eating grits, eat greens. Quit pork, eat fish. And he gives me tranquil pills to take, one each day before I go to work for Mrs. McGovern. You do that, Mizzou, Randy said, and carrying his mug walked out onto the screen upstairs porch overlooking Grove and River. He then climbed the narrow ship's ladder that led to the captain's walk, a rectangle 16 by 8 feet, stoutly planked and railed on the slate roof. Reputedly, this was the highest spot in Timaquin County. From it, he could see all the riverfront estates, docks, and boats, and all of the town of Fort Repose, 3 miles downstream, held in a crook of sun-flecked silver where the Timaquin joined the broader St. John's. This was his town, or had been. In 1838, during the Seminole Wars, a Lieutenant Randolph Rousey Peyton, USN, a Virginian, had been dispatched to this river junction with a force of 18 Marines and 2 small brass cannon. Lieutenant Peyton journeyed south from Cowes Ford, its name patriotically changed to Jacksonville, by longboat. His orders from General Clinch were to throttle Indian communications on the rivers, thus protecting the flank of the troops moving down the east coast from St. Augustine. Lieutenant Peyton built a blockhouse of palm logs on the point, his guns covering the channel. In 2 years, except during one relief expedition overland to New Smyrna, he fought no battles or skirmishes. But he shot game and caught fish for the garrison pot and studied botany and the culture of citrus. The balmy weather, an idyllic life, described in a log now in a teak chest in Randy Bragg's office, inspired the lieutenant to name his outpost Fort Repose. When the war subsided, the fort was decommissioned and Lieutenant Peyton was assigned to sea duty. 4 years later, he returned to Fort Repose with a wife, a daughter, and a grant from the government for 100 acres. He had picked this precise spot for his homestead because it was the highest ground in the area, with a steep gradient to the river, ideal for planting the oranges just imported from Spain in the Far East. Peyton's original house had burned. The present house had been built by his son-in-law, the first Marcus Bragg, a native of Philadelphia and a lawyer eventually sent to the Senate. The captain's walk had been added for the aging Lieutenant Peyton so that with his brass spyglass he could observe what happened at the junction of rivers. Now the Bragg holdings had dwindled to 36 acres, but 30 were planted in prime citrus, navels, mandarins, valencias, and temples, all tended and sold in season by the county cooperative. Each year Randy received checks totaling $8,000 to $10,000 from the cooperative. Half went to his older brother Mark, an Air Force colonel stationed at Offutt Field, headquarters of the Strategic Air Command near Omaha. With his share, plus dividends from a trust established by his father and his occasional fees as an attorney, Randy lived comfortably. Since he drove a new car and paid his bills promptly, the tradespeople of Fort Repose thought him well-to-do. The rich newcomers classed him with the genteel poor. Randy heard music below and knew that Missouri had started his record player and therefore was waxing the floor. Missouri's method was to spread the wax, kick off her shoes, wrap her feet in rags, and then polish by dancing. This was probably as efficient and certainly more fun than using the electric waxer. He dropped into a deck chair and focused his binoculars on Preacher Henry's place, looking for that damn bird in the hammock of pines, palmettos, and scrub oak. The Henrys had lived here as long as the Braggs, for the original Henry had come as slave and manservant to Lieutenant Peyton. Now the Henrys owned a 4-acre enclave at the east boundary of the Bragg Groves. Preacher Henry's father had bought it from Randolph's grandfather for $50 an acre long before the first boom, when land was valued only for what it grew. Preacher was hitching his mule, Balaam, the last mule in Timequin County, so far as anyone knew, to the disc. In this month, Preacher harrowed for his yam and corn planting, while his wife, Hannah, picked and sold tomatoes and put up kumquat preserves. He ought to go down and talk to Preacher about that damn bird, Randy thought. If anyone was likely to observe and recognize a Carolina parakeet floating around, it was Preacher, because Preacher knew all the birds and their calls and habits. He shifted his glasses to focus on the end of the Henry's rickety dock. Two-Tone had 5 bamboo poles out. Two-Tone himself reclined on his side, head resting on his hands so he could watch the corks without effort. Preacher's younger son, Malachi, who was Randy's yard man and reliable as Two-Tone was no account, was not about. Randy heard the phone ringing in his office. The music stopped, and he knew Missouri was answering. Presently, she called from the piazza. "Mr. Randy, it's for you. It's Western Union." "Tell her I'll be right down," Randy said, lifted himself out of the deck chair and backed down the ladder, wondering who would be sending him a telegram. It wasn't his birthday. If something important happened, people phoned. Unless, he remembered that the Air Force sent telegrams when a man was hurt or killed. But it wouldn't be Mark, because for 2 years Mark had been flying a desk. Still, Mark would get in his flying time each month, if possible, for the extra pay. He took the phone from Missouri's hand and braced himself. "Yes," he said. "I have a telegram, Randy. It's really a cable, from San Juan, Puerto Rico. It's signed by Mark. It's really very peculiar." Randy let out his breath, relieved. If Mark had sent the message, then Mark was all right. A man can't pick his relatives, only his friends. But Mark had always been Randy's friend as well as brother. "What's the message say?" "Well, I'll read it to you," Florence said. "And then if you want me to read it again, I'll be glad to. It says, 'Urgent you meet me at Base Ops McCoy noon today. Helen and children flying to Orlando tonight.'" "Alas, Babylon." Florence paused. "That's what it says. Alas, Babylon. Do you want me to repeat the whole thing for you, Randy?" "No, thanks." "I wonder what 'Alas, Babylon' means. Isn't it out of the Bible?"
"I don't know. I guess so."
He knew very well what it meant. He felt sick inside. "There's something else, Randy."
"Yes?"
"Oh, it's nothing. I'll tell you about it next time I see you, and I hope not in those loud pajamas. Goodbye, Randy. You're sure you have the message?"
"I'm sure," he said, hung up, and dropped into the swivel chair. Alas, Babylon was a private, a family signal. When they were boys, he and Mark used to sneak up to the back of the First Afro-Repose Baptist Church on Sunday nights to hear Preacher Henry calling down hellfire and damnation on the sinners in the big cities. Preacher Henry always took his text out of the Revelation of St. John. It seemed that he ended every lurid verse with, "Alas, Babylon," in a voice so resonant you could feel it if you rested your fingertips gently on the warped pine boards of the church. Randy and Mark would crouch under the rear window behind the pulpit, fascinated and wide-eyed, while Preacher Henry described the Babylonian revels, including fornication. Sometimes Preacher Henry made Babylon sound like Miami, and sometimes like Tampa, for he condemned not only fornication, he read the word right out of the Bible, but also horse racing and the dog tracks. Randy could hear him yet, "And I'm telling you right now, all wife swappers, whiskey drinkers, and crap shooters are going to get it. And all them who come out of those sin palaces on the beach, whether they be called hotels or motels, wearing minks and jewels and not much else, they is going to get it. And them fast steppers and Cadillacs and yaller roadsters, they is going to get it, just like it says here in a good book, that great city that was clothed in fine linen and purple and scarlet
and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls. That great city was burned off the face of the earth in an hour. Just 1 hour, alas, Babylon.
Either Preacher Henry was too old, or the Afro-Repose congregation had tired of his scolding and awful prophecies, for he no longer preached except on those Sundays when Afro-Repose's new minister, a light-skinned college graduate, was out of town. Randy and Mark never forgot Preacher Henry's thundering, and from it they borrowed their private synonym for disaster, real or comic, past or future. If one fell off the dock or lost all his cash at poker or failed to make time with the promising Pistolville peace or announced that hurricane or freeze was on the way, the other commiserated with, "Alas, Babylon." But in this telegram it had very special and exact meaning. Mark had secured leave at Christmas season last year and flown down with Helen and the two children, Ben Franklin and Peyton, for a week. On their last evening at Fort Repose, after the others were in bed, Mark and Randy had sat here in this office, peering into the bourbon decanter and the deep anxieties of their hearts, trying to divine the future. Christmas had been a time of troubles, a time of confusions at home and tensions abroad, but in his whole life, Randy could recall no other sort of time. There had always been depression, or war, or threat of war. Mark, who was in SAC intelligence, had rolled the old-fashioned globe 3 feet through from its place in the window bay so that the desk lamp shone on it. It was a globe purchased by their grandfather, the diplomat, before the First World War, so that the countries, some with unfamiliar names, seemed oddly scrambled. The continents and seas were the same, which was all that mattered. As Mark talked, his face became grave, almost gaunt, and his index finger traced great circle routes across the cracking surface, missile and bomber trajectories. He then drew a rough chart with two lines that intersected. The line that continued upward after the intersection belonged to the Soviet Union, and the time of the intersection was right then.
"How did it happen?" Randy had asked. "Where did we slip?"
"It wasn't lack of money," Mark had replied. "It was state of mind. Chevrolet mentality shying away from a spaceship world. Nations are like people. When they grow old and rich and fat, they get conservative. They exhaust their energy trying to keep things the way they are, and that's against nature. Oh, the services were to blame, too. Maybe even SAC. We designed the most beautiful bombers in the world and built them by the thousands. We improved and modified them each year like new model cars. We couldn't bear the thought that jet bombers themselves might be out of style. Right now we're in the position of the Federal Navy with its wooden steam frigates up against the Confederate ironclad. It is a state of mind that money alone won't cure."
"What will?" Randy asked.
"Men. Men like John Erickson to invent a monitor to face the Merrimack. Bold men, audacious men, tenacious men. Impatient oddball men like Rickover pounding desks for his atomic sub. Ruthless men who will fire the deadheads and ass-kissers. Rude men who will tell the unimaginative business-as-usual 7 carbon sons of bitches to go take a jump at a galloping goose. Young men, because we've got to be a young country again. If we get that kind of men, we may hack it, if the other side gives us time."
"Will they?"
Mark had spun the globe and shrugged. "I don't know. If I think the balloon is about to go up, I'm going to send Helen and the kids down here. When a man dies, and his children die with him, then he is dead entirely, leaving nothing to show."
"Do you think they'd be safer here than in Omaha?
After all, we've got the Jacks Naval Air Complex to the north of us, and Homestead and Miami to the south, and Eglin to the northwest, and MacDill and Tampa to the southwest, and the Missile Test Center on Canaveral to the east, and McCoy and Orlando right at the front door only 40 miles off. What about fallout?"
"There isn't any place that'll be absolutely safe. With fallout and radiation, it'll be luck. The size of configuration of the weapons, altitude of the fireball, direction of the wind. But I do know Helen and the children won't have much chance in Omaha. SAC headquarters has got to be the enemy's number one target. I'll bet they've programmed 3 5-megaton ICs for Offutt. And since our house is 8 miles from the base, any kind of near miss does it. Mark snapped his fingers. Like that. Not that I think it'll do the enemy any good. Command automatically shifts to other combat control centers, and anyway, all our crews know their targets. But they'll hit SAC headquarters, hoping for temporary paralysis. A little delay is all they'd need. I'll have to be there, at Offutt, in the hole. But the least a man can do is give his children a chance to grow up, and I think they'd have a better chance in Fort Repose than Omaha. So if I see it's coming, and there is time, I'll send Helen and the kids down here, and I'll try to give you a warning so you can get set for it.
How?
Mark smiled. I won't call you up and say, hey, Randy, the Russians are about to attack us. Phones aren't secure, and I don't think my CNC or the air staff would approve. But if you hear, alas, Babylon, you'll know that's it. Randy had forgotten none of this talk. A week or so later, thinking about Mark's words, Randy had decided to go into politics. He would start in the state legislature, and in a few years be ready to run for Congress. He'd be the kind of leader Mark wanted. It hadn't worked out that way. He couldn't even beat Porky Logan, a gross man whose vote could be bought for $50, who bragged that he had not got beyond a 7th grade, but that he could get more new roads and state money for Timokin County than any half-baked radical, undoubtedly backed by the Burrheads and the NAACP, who didn't even know that the Supreme Court was controlled by Moscow. So Randy's fiasco had been inspired by that night, and now the night bore something worse. He wondered what Mark was doing in Puerto Rico, and why his warning had come from there. It should have come from Washington or London or Omaha or Colorado Springs rather than San Juan. It was true that SAC had a big base, Ramey, in Puerto Rico, but it was no use guessing. He'd know at noon. Of one thing he was certain. If Mark expected it to come, it would probably come. His brother was no alarmist. Randy sometimes allowed emotions to distort logic. Mark never did. Mark was capable of calculating odds in war or poker to the final decimal, which was why he was a deputy chief of intelligence at SAC and soon would have his star. Randy knew there were 1,000 things he should be doing, but he couldn't think of any of them. He became aware of a rumba rhythm in the living room, and presently Missouri skated into view, feet bundled with waxing cloth, shoulders moving and hips bouncing with elephantine elegance intent on her polishing. He yelled, "Missouri!" "Yes, sir." Her forward motion stopped, but her hips continued to wobble and feet shuffle. "Quit that strutting and make up the 3 bedrooms on the front. Colonel Bragg's family will be here tomorrow."
"Oh, ain't that nice? Just like last year."
"No, not like last year. The colonel's not coming with them. Just Mrs. Bragg and Ben Franklin and Peyton." Missouri peered through the door at him.
"Mr. Randy, you don't look good. Them telegrams are yellow death. You get bad news or something? Ain't nothing happened to Colonel Mark?"
"No, I'm driving over to McCoy to meet him at noon."
"Oh, that's good. How come the children up north get out of school so quick?"
"I don't know."
"I'll dust good and make up the beds and put towels and soaps in the bathrooms, just like last year."
"Thanks, Mizzou. That's fine."
"Caleb's going to be happy to see Ben Franklin," Missouri said.
Caleb was Missouri's son, and just Ben's age, 13. Last year, Randy had let them take the boat out on the river fishing, just as Randy, as a boy, had fished with Caleb's uncle, Malachi, except that 20 years ago the boat was a skiff, powered by muscle and oars instead of a sleek fiberglass job with a 30-horse kicker. Missouri gathered up her cleaning materials and left Randy alone with his nightmare. He shook his head, but he didn't wake up. The nightmare was real. Slowly he forced his mind to function. Slowly he forced himself to imagine the unimaginable. He must make a list of the things Helen and the children would need. He recalled that there was nothing stocked in the big kitchen downstairs and little in the utility room except some steaks in the freezer and a few canned staples. My God, if there was going to be a war, they'd need stocks of everything. He looked at his watch.
He had yet to shave and dress, and he must allow an hour and a half for the drive to McCoy, 10 miles south of Orlando, when you considered the main highways clogged with tourists and Orlando's infuriating and hopeless traffic tangle on a sunny payday less than 3 weeks before Christmas. And there might be some delay at the McCoy gate. He decided to give himself 2 hours on the road. Still, he could start the list, and there was one thing he should do right away. Ben Franklin drank a quart of milk a day, and Peyton, his 11-year-old sister, even more. He telephoned Golden Dew Dairy and revised his delivery order drastically upward. This was Randy's first act to meet the emergency, and it was to prove the least useful. 2. Randy left the house in time to see Missouri wedge herself under the wheel of the Henry's Model A Ford, an antique, so certified with a Q-tag issued by the state, but kept in perfect running order by Malachi's mechanical ingenuity. "I haven't finished, but I got to go now," she said. "Mrs. McGovern, she holds the clock on me. I'll be back tomorrow." The Model A, listing to port with Missouri's weight, bounced down the pebbled driveway. Randy got into his new Bonneville. It was a sweet car, a compromise between a sports job and a hardtop, long, low, very fast, and a lot of fun, even though its high-compression engine drank premium fuel in quantity. At 11, approaching Orlando on Route 50, turned on the radio for the news. Turkey had appealed to the UN for an investigation of border penetrations by Syria. Syria charged Israel with planning a preventive war. Israel accused Egypt of sending snooper planes over its defenses. Egypt claimed its ships, bound from the Black Sea to Alexandria, were being delayed in the straits and charged Turkey with a breach of the Montreux Convention. Russia accused Turkey and the United States of plotting to crush Syria and warned France, Italy, Greece, and Spain that any nations harboring American bases would be involved in a general war and erased from the earth. The Secretary of State was somewhere over the Atlantic, bound for conferences in London. The Soviet ambassador to Washington had been recalled for consultation. There were riots in France. It all sounded bad, but familiar as an old scratchy record. He had heard it all before in almost the same words back in 57 and 58. So why push the panic button? Mark could be wrong. He couldn't know for certain that the balloon was going up. Unless he knew something fresh. Something that had not appeared in the newspapers or been broadcast. Shortly before noon, Florence Wecek hung her Back at One sign on the office door and walked down Yulee Street to meet Alice Cooksey at the Pink Flamingo. Fridays, they always lunched together. Alice, tiny, drab in black and gray, an active, angry sparrow of a woman, arrived late. She hurried to Florence's table and said, "I'm sorry. I've just had a squabble with Kitty Offenhaus." "Oh, dear," Florence said. "Again?" Kitty was secretary of the PTA, past president of the Frangipani Circle, treasurer of the Women's Club, and a member of the library board. Also, she was the wife of Luther Bubba Offenhaus, chief tail twister of the Lions Club, vice president of the Chamber of Commerce, and deputy director of civil defense for the whole county. He owned the most prosperous business in town, the Offenhaus Mortuary, and a twin real estate development, Repose in Peace Park. Alice lifted the menu. It fluttered. She set it down quickly and said, "Yes, again. I guess I'll have the tuna fish salad." "You should eat more, Alice," Florence said, noticing how white and pinched her friend's face looked. "What happened?"
"Kitty came in and said she'd heard rumors that we had books by Carl Rowan and Walter White. I told her the rumors were true, and did she want to borrow one?"
"What did she say?" Florence put down her fork, no longer interested in her chicken patty.
"Said they were subversive and anti-South. She's a daughter of the Confederacy, and ordered me to take them off the shelves. I told her that as long as I was librarian, they would stay there. She said she was going to bring it before the board, and if necessary, take it up with Porky Logan. He's on the investigating committee in Tallahassee.
Alice, you're going to lose your job. Kitty Offenhouse was the most influential person in Fort Repose, with the exception of Edgar Quisenberry, who owned and ran the bank.
I don't think so. I told her that if anything like that happened, I'd call the St. Petersburg Times and Tampa Tribune and Miami Herald, and they'd send reporters and photographers. I said, Kitty, can't you see your picture on the front page in the headline, Undertaker's Wife Cremates Books?
This was the most fascinating news Florence had heard in weeks. What happened then?
Nothing at all. If I may borrow an expression from one of my younger readers, she left in an 8-cylinder huff.
You wouldn't really call the papers, would you? Alice spoke carefully, understanding fully that everything would soon be repeated.
I certainly would. But I don't think I'll have to. You see, publicity would hurt Bubba's business. 1/3 of Bubba's customers are Negroes, and another 1/3 Yankees who come down here to live on their pensions and stay to die.
She lifted her bright, fiercely blue eyes and added, as if repeating one of the commandments,
"Censorship and thought control can exist only in secrecy and darkness."
And that was all?
That was all.
Alice tried her salad.
What have you been doing, Florence?
Florence could think of no adventure or even any news culled from the wire that could compete with telling off Kitty Offenhouse, except her experience with Randy Bragg. She had pledged herself not to say anything about Randy to anyone, but she could trust Alice, who was worldly wise in spite of her appearance, and who might even when younger have encountered a peeping Tom herself. So Florence told about Randy and his binoculars and how he had stared at her that morning.
"It's almost unbelievable, isn't it?"
she concluded.
"It is unbelievable,"
Alice said flatly.
"But I saw him at it." "I don't care. I know the Bragg boys. Even before you came here, Florence, I knew them. I knew Judge Bragg well, very well."
Florence remembered vague reports many years back of Alice Cooksey having gone with Judge Bragg before the judge married Gertrude. But that made no difference to what went on in the Bragg house now. "You'll have to admit that those Bragg boys are a little peculiar," Florence said. "You should have seen the cable Randy got from Mark this morning. Urgent they meet at McCoy today. Helen and the children flying to Orlando tonight. You know those children can't be out of school yet. And the last two words didn't make any sense at all. Alas, Babylon. Isn't that crazy?"
"Those boys aren't crazy," Alice said. "They've always been bright boys. Full of hell, yes. But at least they could read, which is more than I can say for the children nowadays. Do you know that Randy read every history in the library before he was 16?
"I don't think that has anything to do with his sex habits," Florence said. She leaned across the table and touched Alice's arm. "Alice, come out to my house tonight for the weekend. I want you to see for yourself."
"I can't. I keep the library open Saturdays. That's my only chance to get the young ones. Evenings and Sundays, they're paralyzed by TV.
"I'm open Saturday mornings, too, so we can drive in together. I'll pick you up when you're through tomorrow evening. It'll be a change for you out in the country, away from that stuffy room." Alice hesitated. It would be nice to visit with Florence, but she hated to accept favors she couldn't repay. She said,
"Well, we'll see."
When Alice returned to the library, 3 old-timers, too old for shuffleboard or the lawn bowlers club, were bent over the periodical table.
Like mummies, she thought, partially unwrapped.
One of the mummies leaned slowly over until his nose fell into the fold of Cosmopolitan. Alice walked over to the table and made certain he still breathed. She let him nap on, smiled at the other two, and darted into the reference room with its towering top-heavy stacks. From the first stack, religious and spiritual works in steady demand, she brought down the King James Bible. She believed she would find the words in Revelation, and she did. She read 2 verses, lips moving, words murmuring in her throat.
"And the kings of the earth, who have committed fornication and lived deliciously with her, shall bewail her and lament for her when they shall see the smoke of her burning. Standing afar off for the fear of her torment, saying, Alas, alas, that great city Babylon, that mighty city, for in 1 hour is thy judgment come.
Alice put the Bible back on its shelf and walked head down to her cracked oak desk like a schoolmarm's desk on a dais in the main hallway. She sat there, staring at the green blotter, at the antiquated pen in the glass inkwell, at the wooden file filled with readers' cards, at the stack of publishers' spring lists. Alone of all the people in Fort Repose, Alice Cooksey knew Mark Bragg well enough and had absorbed sufficient knowledge of the world's illness through the printed word to understand that the book she had ordered from those spring lists might never be delivered. She had small fear of death, and of man none at all, but the formlessness of what was to come overwhelmed her. She always associated Babylon with New York, and she wished now that she lived on Manhattan, where one could die in a bright millisecond without suffering, without risking the indignity of panic. She picked up the telephone and called Florence. She would come out for the weekend, or even longer, if Florence was agreeable. When she set down the phone, Alice felt steadier. If it came soon, she would have a friendly hand to hold. She would not be alone. The air police sergeant at McCoy's main gate questioned Randy and then allowed him to call Lieutenant Colonel Paul Hart, a squadron commander and a friend of Mark's. Hart had been to Fort Repose to fish for bass, first as Mark's guest and later on several occasions as a guest of Randy, so he was something more than an acquaintance. Randy said he had had a wire from Mark to meet him at noon, and Hart said, He whistled through here yesterday, didn't expect him back so soon. Anyway, drive to base ops. We'll go out on the line and meet him together. Let me talk to the air police. I'll clear you through. Driving through the base, Randy sensed a change since his last visit the year before. Physically, McCoy looked the same. It felt different. The air police questioning had been sharper and more serious. That wasn't the difference. He realized something was missing, and then he had it. Where were all the people? McCoy seemed almost deserted, with less activity and fewer men and fewer cars than a year ago. He saw no other civilians. He saw no women, not even around the clubs and the BX. The most congested area on the base was the steps and lawn in front of the alert barracks opposite wing headquarters, where standby crewmen, rigid and stiff in pressure suits, talked and smoked. Trucks, tailgates down, were back to the curb. Drivers slouched over their wheels as if they had been there a long time. He drove on to base operations and parked close to the flight line fence. Last year he had seen B-47s, tankers, and fat transports stretching their wings tip to tip, the length of the line, miles. Now their numbers had dwindled. He counted fewer than 20 B-47s and guessed that the wing was in Africa or Spain or England on 90-day foreign duty. But this could not be so, because Paul Hart, winner of bombing and navigation trophies, a select crew aircraft commander, would have led the flight. Hart, a stocky, bandy-legged man with a punched-in nose, a fighter's chin, and an easy grin, met him at the door of operations. "Hi, Randy," he said. "Just checked the board. Mark will touch down in 8 minutes. How's the fishing?" "It's been lousy," he looked up at the windsock. "But it'll get better if this high sticks around and the wind holds from the east. What's he flying?" "He's not flying anything. He's riding soft and plush in a C-135. That's the transport version of our new jet tanker with a lot of Offutt brass. Other brass, that is. I hear he gets his star soon. Only promotion I'll ever get is to a B-58.
"Penalty for being a hot pilot," Randy said. "What's going on around here? Looks like a ghost town. You boys shutting up shop?"
"You haven't heard about SAC's interim dispersal?"
"Vaguely, yes, on some of the commentaries."
"Well, we're not shouting about it. We try to keep half the wing off this base because where we're standing right now is a primary target. We farm out our planes to fighter fields and navy fields and even commercial airports, and we try to keep 10% of the wing airborne at all times. And if you look down there in front of the jumbo hangar, you'll see four standby 47s bombed up and ready to go. Damn expensive way to run an air force. Randy looked. They were there, wings drooping with full tanks bound to earth by slender umbilical cords, the starter cables. I didn't mean the planes so much as the people, Randy said. Where's everybody? Oh, that. Hart frowned as if deciding how much could be said and what words to use. The papers know about it, but they aren't printing it, he said finally. And the people around Orlando must know about it by now, so it can't be any great secret. We've been on sort of a modified alert for 4 or 5 weeks. Maybe I should call it a creeping evacuation. We've cleared the area of all civilian and non-essential personnel, and we're encouraging everybody to move their families out of the blast zone. You see, Randy, we can't expect 3 to 6 hours warning anymore. If we're lucky, we might get 15 minutes. Randy nodded. He noticed long red missiles slung under the wings of the standby B-47s. He recognized them from the newspaper photographs as the Rascal, an air-to-ground H-bomb carrier. Is that red baby much help? He asked. That red baby, Hart said, is what we call the crew saver. The Ruskies are no dopes. They'll try to stop us with missiles air-to-air and ground-to-air, beam riders, heat-seekers, sound finders, and for all I know, smellers. It'll be no milk run, but with the Rascal and some other gadgets, we don't have to write ourselves off as a kamikaze corps. We won't have to penetrate their inner defense zones. We can lay off target and let that red baby fly. It knows where to go. Do you know what? What? Paul Hart's smile had vanished, and he looked older, and when he spoke, it was gravely. When the whistle blows, I'll have a better chance if I'm in my aircraft headed for target than if I'm sitting at home with my feet propped up drinking a scotch and Martha rubbing the kinks out of my neck, and our little place on the lake is 5 miles from here. So I'm a man of peace. I wish Martha and the kids lived in Fort Repose. Randy heard the low whine of jet engines at fractional power and saw a cigar-shaped C-135 line up with the runway in its swoop downward. Presently it wheeled into a taxi strip and braked in front of operations. A flag, 3 white stars on a blue field, popped out of the cockpit, indicating that a lieutenant general was aboard and alerting McCoy to provide the courtesies due such rank. The 3-star general was first down the ramp, his pink-cheeked aide scurrying about his heels like an anxious puppy. Mark was last off. Randy waved and caught his eye, and Mark waved back but did not smile. Coming down the ramp and across the concrete, knees bare in tropical uniform, Mark looked like a slightly larger edition of Randy, an inch taller, a shade broader. At 30 feet, they looked like twins with the same jet hair, white teeth behind mobile lips, quizzical eyes set deep, the same rakish walk and swing of shoulders, cleft in chin, and emphatic nose with a bony bump on the bridge. At 3 feet, fine, deep lines showed around Mark's eyes and mouth. Gray appeared in his black thicket. His jaw thrust out an extra half inch. His face was leaner. At 3 feet, they were entirely different, and it was apparent Mark was the older, harder, and probably wiser man. Mark put one hand on Hart's shoulder and the other on Randy's and walked them toward the building. Paul, he told Hart, you better get with General Haycock. He's hungry, and when he gets hungry, he gets fierce. How about helping his aide dig up some transport and get him over to the Oak Club? We're only here to gas up. Takeoff is in 50 minutes. Hart looked up and saw 3 blue Air Force sedans swing up the driveway. There's the general's transport right there, he said, and then realizing that Mark had tactfully implied he wanted to be alone with his brother, added, but I'll go along to the Oak Club and get the mess officer on the ball. He shook hands and said, see you, Mark, next time around. Sure, Mark said. He turned to Randy. Where's your car? I've got a lot to say and not much time to say it. We can talk in the car. But first, let's get some candy or something inside out. We didn't load any flight lunches at Ramey. The front seat of the Bonneville was like a sunny, comfortable private office. Randy asked the essential question first. What time do Helen and the children get in?
Mark brought a notebook out of his hip pocket. 3:30 tomorrow morning, local time, at Orlando Municipal. Carmody, he's wing commander at Ramey, has a friend in the Eastern Office in San Juan. He ramrodded it through for me. The plane leaves Omaha at 7:10 tonight. One change in Chicago.
Isn't that a little rough on Helen and the kids?
They can sleep all the way from Chicago to Orlando. It'll be just as tough on you meeting them. The important thing is I got the reservation. This time of year it took some doing.
What's the great rush? Randy demanded. What the hell's going on?
Contain yourself, son, Mark said. I'm going to give you a complete briefing.
Have you told Helen yet?
I sent her a cable from San Juan. Just told